Well, good morning, everyone. We are studying Isaiah, and this morning our goal is to start around chapter 6 and work our way to chapter 10. And so thank you for being here, and open up your Old Testaments there, and we'll begin shortly. Let's start with a prayer. Ray Conies, could you lead our thoughts, please?
Let's pray. Dear Father in heaven, thank you that we're able to be here today to study your word and be with Philip now as he brings us his thoughts on your servant Isaiah's book. And help us, Father, to be good listeners and students. And Father, be with those who can't be here for health problems and challenges. And help us to minister to them any way we can. And be with the other teachers meeting today also. And thank you, Father, for the message and the content that we're about to hear today. And it shows your love for us and your mercy and forgiveness when we're faithful to you. And we pray all this in your son's name. Amen.
So, the prophets regarding Bible writings is an area we probably spend the least amount of time in those books. I think that can be safely said. We're trying to compensate for that this year, and I'll set that. And they're also the books that are the most challenging to us typically. And we continue to recycle some of the ideas and thoughts about the prophets this year in different venues so that we can get a bit better grip on the prophets. And so this is sort of putting together some things we've talked about off and on over the last several weeks already. Why is it that we struggle with the prophets? Actually, some of the language is pretty simple. It's figurative in many cases, but it's pretty simple. There are some sections that are very challenging, especially the prophetic aspects as far as the foretelling. We'll talk more about that even in the sermon next Sunday, Lord willing. I think one of the main reasons why the prophets challenge us is because the prophets are written within a historical context. There's a historical background to a certain prophetic book, whether it be Isaiah, whether it be Hosea, Malachi, whatever. And that historical background is assumed when you open the book. It's not always something you can put together as you read the book. You get little snippets, but you have to have the other Old Testament history to do that. Well, one of the reasons why the prophets are a challenge to us is because the divided kingdom period is a challenge to us. The divided kingdom period recorded there in 1st, 2nd Kings, as well as the Chronicles, which really focuses just on Judah, that is a section we spend the least amount of time in the Old Testament as far as the Old Testament narrative goes. And on top of that, it's a challenging history. So we've emphasized that over the last several weeks. You really have to be on your toes when you study the divided kingdom. You got two different kingdoms and their histories are intertwined. And you got kings on both sides, and sometimes their names are alike, and sometimes their names are identical. They may be 100 years apart, but the names are the same name. And so it is so challenging to keep that straight sometimes. And it's a very quick history. It's a very concise history. And so what that means is when you study the prophets, you got to do some heavy lifting. You just have to work a little harder at it. A lot of you are very familiar, like, with the Gospels and the book of Acts and the letters of the New Testament and the books of Genesis and Exodus and the writings of David and the Psalms and Solomon and the Proverbs. You know why you are? Because you spent a lot of time with it. You've made effort. You put something into that. So whenever you encounter someone who knows little about the Bible and you start talking with them and they're like, how do you know all these things? Well, because you did the work. You did the lifting. That's why. So all it is a matter of putting the time in and doing the lifting. And so in today's section, though there is always a historical backdrop, there is a real strong dimension of a historical backdrop to Isaiah 7, 8, 9, and 10 especially, those chapters. And you can sort of piece it together a little bit as you study those chapters, but it's a challenge. And so that's one of the important things we need to do this morning as we work through this material. So let's look at chapter 6 first of all. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on chapter 6, and the reason why is because I did a whole sermon on it. Thank you, Kathy. It's so good to know that somebody remembered. Thank you very much. So that was, we studied Isaiah 6 as our introduction to the prophets. That was the first sermon I did on the prophets back in January, even before Tommy came and visited with us that weekend. And so I just think it's a great introduction to what's happening in the prophetic literature. It's so important to us. Well, what do you make of this? Here we are in our English Bibles, and this is the 6th chapter of Isaiah. And it contains Isaiah having a vision of the Lord that leads to his calling to be a prophet. Now, where would most of us think Isaiah's call to be a prophet should go in this book? Very beginning, at the very first chapter. And you see that in Jeremiah, and you see it in Ezekiel in a way. So that makes perfect sense. But here it is. And you know what? I really don't know why. And sometimes we waste time trying to figure out why it's placed, something is placed somewhere, when really we should focus on what does the placement do for us. For instance, have you ever been reading a book or watching a film and there's a flashback? So the story is going, but then there's a flashback to something that happened 10 years before. And it serves a purpose to put the flashback there. I think it's what's happening. So Isaiah, the first 5 chapters start off really with very representative prophecies. Prophecies about Israel and Judah's sins. Prophecies about God's judgment. Prophecies about God's hope that he's offering in the future for his people. So it's very representative. You can take the first 5 chapters of Isaiah and say, wow, this is just like this and this and this that's found in other places in the prophetic writings. And so after this sampling of Isaiah's writings and Isaiah's preaching, then we have the background as to how he became a prophet, like a flashback. And so, how did this vision that he has, we're going to spend much time on it, how does it affect Isaiah? He sees the Lord as much as a human can. It's a vision. Goes without saying, he saw a grand, glorious scene, okay?
And he also saw himself in
relation. That's right. It humbled him, and he confessed that he was a person of unclean lips, living among a people with unclean lips. He realized his great deficiency before God, doesn't he? And then there's this symbolic part of it that his mouth is cleansed, you know, with this coal, hot coal from God. And then God's looking for someone to go and preach. And Isaiah said what? Here am I, send me. And what does God tell him about his task, his mission? They're not going to listen to you. I want you to go preach to these people, however, they're not going to listen to you. That's really not the recipe for an excitement about a job, is it? It's not at all. But hopefully, after we've read what we've read, and Jonah and Joel and Amos and Hosea and our work here in Isaiah and other things we're doing on Wednesday nights, hopefully you understand the value of that. That these prophets are not going to get a great response. And so, there's a huge lesson there. We do what we do for God, not for people. And whenever we catch ourselves saying, well, people don't appreciate this, and people aren't doing this, and people aren't responding this way, and people aren't cooperating here, we're missing the whole point. I love every one of you, and I want the best for you, and I want you to go to heaven. And you're my brother, and you're valuable to me. And it's taken me a long time to learn this lesson. But I don't preach and teach for you. For God. Now, the secondary goal is that in that you're helped. And I try to be very conscious of what you need and what would help you, and take that into consideration. But that's a lesson we all need. when you serve your brethren, when you do things in the church, when you do things in the kingdom, you're first doing it for God. That's it. And if other people appreciate it, if other people, you know, respond in a positive way, that's great. If they don't, was God pleased? That's all that matters. It's all that matters. And these prophets had to live that every day. And it might be, we talked about how they're courageous and tough. These guys are made out of grit. There's no soft tissue among these guys. Okay? And I think maybe that's why they knew what they were up against. They were up against walls. And so they had, their heads were hard. These guys were stubborn. They were stubborn. And you see that even with the non-writing prophets, that oftentimes the people or the kings would get really aggravated with how stubborn they were. They were stubborn for God and His will. Okay, chapter 6 there. So keep that flashback in mind. Anything you want to add to that? Chapter 6. It's just a real healthy chapter to go back and read every now and then. Okay? So let's look at chapter 7 now. I'm going to go ahead and give you the title of this section, and that is King Ahaz, who is a king of Judah, which is the southern kingdom. So he is a king in the lineage of whom? Who's his ancestor? His famous David. Okay? He's in the Davidic kingdom. So he is assured that Ephraim, which is another name for Israel, and that's very common in these chapters here in Isaiah. Why is Ephraim a synonymous term for Israel, the northern kingdom? What was Ephraim? Ephraim was a tribe. Ephraim was a son of Joseph, and he got a large portion. So it's like saying things that happen in California, Texas, New York and Florida affect all the United States. They're the biggest states, okay, that carry a lot of weight and things that happen, okay, whether economically, politically, socially, okay, things that happen in those places creep into the other states, okay, good or bad, technologies, everything. That's Ephraim. Ephraim was a leading, dominant tribe because one of these early wicked kings of Israel, first of all, made Samaria the capital. They put a lot of the idolatrous activities in Samaria and some of the cities, especially some of the southern cities. And so it just becomes a trend-setting tribe. So it becomes synonymous with Israel. So King Ahaz of Judah is assured that Ephraim, or Israel, and Syria is going to fall. So look at this map here. So here's Israel and here's Judah. Here's Jerusalem and then here's Samaria, which is the capital of Israel. You'll notice here that just to the north of Israel is Syria, which is roughly in the same place where Syria is today, which is very much in the news. It's also referred to in the prophetic writings as Aram. This is Syria, not Assyria. This is Syria. And so this is a neighboring kingdom to Israel. So if Syria is your neighbor, they can either be a what or a what? Friend or a foe. So that, watch how Syria plays in here. So in ancient times, just like modern times, international relations were characterized by alliances and threats. Just take that template. Alliances and threats. Think about all the modern current events right now that are being played out in light of that template of who's aligned with whom and who's a threat to whom. Okay? It's being played out in the Middle East right now. It's being played out in Eastern Europe regarding Ukraine and Russia. That's the way it's always been. So you would think that though they had this division and separated, that Israel and Judah should have more in common than, you know, things to separate them. That's not the case. Sometimes a lot of cultures that are similar will combat each other. So Israel and Judah at times are on fairly friendly terms, but most of the time they're not, from the point that they divided. And Israel is usually the bully. They've got more money. They've got more people. And so they tend to be the heavy. And what has happened here is that Israel has aligned themselves with Syria, and they are eyeing toppling Judah. That Israel really would like to topple Judah, and with Syria's help. And of course, they're all looking for something to gain from it. Okay? So, this is a very threatening time for Judah. Well, go with me. Who is this King Ahaz? Go with me to 2 Kings chapter 16. We'll spend a moment on this because it's of benefit. 2 Kings chapter 16. We know that all of the Israelite, all of Israel's kings were idolatrous. All of Israel's kings were wicked men. Judah, it's a mixed bag. Well, look at Ahaz. Chapter 16, Rick, will you read verse 1 to 4 about Ahaz? He's introduced to us, and let's see what he's like.
In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, became king. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, and even made his sons pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out from before the sons of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree.
All right, thank you. Now, look at his family. His father, whose name was Jotham, did walk faithfully with the Lord. And his grandfather was Josiah, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Maybe I messed that up. See what I mean? You got to be on your toes. I'm serious. Okay. Uzziah. I'm sorry. Josiah is much later. Uzziah is his grandfather, another faithful king. And then his son, look at chapter 18, at the beginning of 18. Who's his son? Hezekiah, who's a reformer. He's one of the real outstanding, faithful kings to the Lord, which tells us something. Why did he have to be a reformer? It's because of his predecessor, his father, Ahaz. Ahaz was one of the unfaithful kings of Judah. How bad was he? Pretty bad. How bad was he? What? He offered his children to the false gods. That seems to be like the low point. Manasseh did the same thing. That really precipitates the fall of Judah. So when you stoop that low as an idolater to offer your children to these false gods, that's bad. So that's Ahaz. Got it? And we're told in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, that Isaiah was a prophet during the reign of Uzziah and Ahaz here and Hezekiah after him. And so this is that period in which Isaiah is working as a prophet. And look what happens. Rick, keep reading. Read verse 5.
Then Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him.
All right, so there is that description of Israel and Aram or Syria forming an alliance and coming against Judah and coming against Jerusalem. Yet, and this is still so today, there are strategic points where a military has to take that point, take that location, or they can't subdue the land. Judah will be invaded several times. The critical question is, will Jerusalem fall? If Jerusalem falls, Judah's done for. If Jerusalem does not fall, then they have a chance of survival. There's a good chance of survival. So that just happens, okay? That just happens in these kinds of affairs, even in modern times. So I think if Kyiv fell in Ukraine, that would be it probably for Ukraine. So that's just how these things kind of go. So see the threat that Ahaz is under here by Aram or Syria and Israel to the north. And then look down at verse 7. Read that, Rick.
Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and deliver me from the hand of the king of Aram and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are rising up against me.
Okay, and what is described over the next couple of verses is that when you hire help to come help you, what must you do to get their help? You got to pay. And so he had to strip resources and treasures of Judah to pay Assyria to help him. So do you see that? Look who's entered the scene. Assyria. Much more on them later. So what was Ahaz's stance and response to the invasion of Israel and Syria? How was he going to handle the situation?
Get help.
Get help from Assyria. Well, let's go back to Isaiah 7. To whom should have he looked for help? God. You talk about a consistent pattern in these kings of the Old Testament. It's a fascinating relationship, the kings and the prophets. It's fascinating. Is that when a king would rely on God, or a king would turn to other nations for help, that was critical. And some of the kings of Judah were tempted in that, and this is one of them. So let's go to Isaiah 7 now. Look at verse 1 and 2. Justin, can you read verse 1 and 2 for us? Isaiah 7, back to Isaiah, sorry. Isaiah 7, 1 to 2. Now, we've got the historical backdrop. That's the situation. Now, look at Isaiah's account of it. And this is one of those occasions where there's some narrative dropped in to Isaiah's prophecy. So Isaiah 7, 1 and 2.
Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. When it was reported to the house of David, saying, "The Arameans have camped in Ephraim," his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind.
Okay, so how did Ahaz respond to the threat? How did he emotionally react to the threat? Verse 2. In Texas, they say he was what? Shaking in his boots. Okay. He's shaking like a trees in the forest for a great wind kind of thing.
One another.
That's right. His knees smote one another. His knees smoteth one another. That's King Rick Harrington's King James Version. So that this is a real serious threat. That's the whole point of that. Well, Isaiah injects himself here. The Lord has him to speak. And look at verses 3 to 9. Becky, will you read that for us? Isaiah 7, 3 to 9.
Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take heed and be quiet. Do not fear nor be faint-hearted. For these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria, and the son of Remaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, "Let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves, and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years Ephraim will be broken, so that it will not even be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe me, surely you will not be established."
Right. So in spite of Ahaz's unfaithfulness, God speaks to Ahaz through Isaiah and gives him what here? Hope, assurance, comfort. In verse 4, what does he call Israel and Syria or Aram? Little smoldering firebrands. Is that a depiction of their great strength? No, it's they're small and weak. Now, did they look small and weak probably to Ahaz? No. But to whom did they look small and weak? To God. In the prophets, what we have is God's view of things. If only we could develop that. Allow the scriptures to shape our vision of things. So, and in verse 8, What prophecy does he make about Syria or in Damascus is their capital, as it still is, and of Ephraim and Samaria? What prediction is made? Shattered. And how specific is this prophecy of their demise? In 65 years. Wow. And there should be comfort in that specific. Now, the problem is what? With 60, you got a problem today, and somebody says, hey, this is all going to be taken care of in 65 years. First of all, I'm out of here in 65 years. What about you, Frank? What will you be doing in 65 years? Okay. Okay. So, Frank and I are both out of here in 65 years. Okay. And so, that's just how it is. There's some people in this audience that might be around 65 years. But that doesn't seem to be a great comfort. And this is, wow, this is one of the important points when you read the prophets, especially about the Messiah. There are things said to comfort the people. But it's going to happen 65 years later, or 70 years later, or 200 years later, or 400 years later. Okay. It's a real challenge. We'll deal with that a little bit more later. But God is telling him, don't worry about them. And actually, he's giving Ahaz a chance. In verse 9, look at the end of verse 9. The English Standard says, if you're not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. What do other translations say there at the end of verse 9?
You will not last.
You won't last.
Established.
Okay. So, if you don't have faith, you don't have anything. In other words, if you'll stand in your faith, you'll stand. In other words, if you'll listen to me and trust me, you'll make it. That's what he's telling Ahaz through Isaiah. And you're talking about really giving him a chance here. And then in verse 10, again, the Lord said, this is probably another occasion, as these events are not happening overnight. Look at verse 10 and 11. Tommy talked about this chapter real quickly in one of his sermons. But look at verse 10 and 11. What does the Lord offer Ahaz? A sign. What was Ahaz's response to the sign? Verse 12. No. And the way he couches it is what? I don't want to trouble the Lord and tempt the Lord that you have to prove something to me. Okay. It sounds like Ahaz is so profoundly spiritual that God, you don't have to do that for me. Well, how spiritual was Ahaz? He didn't even have a thimbleful of true spirituality in him. We could say that he was a godless pagan. That'd be a fair assessment in light of what we read a while ago and Rick read for us, 2 Kings 16. He doesn't want God's help in this. Why? What's his plan?
Assyria.
Well, two things happen here over the next couple of chapters. One is God's going to give him a sign anyway. And the other thing is he's going to tell him what Assyria really is, what they're going to do. Yeah, Jeff? Yeah.
The irony is that getting them to focus on that part of the world is not a good thing.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of irony here. Assyria is not their help. Assyria is going to be their curse. So, the sign, according to verse 14, is what? A virgin shall give birth. Now, there's some controversy about this term virgin in the original Hebrew language. It basically means a young maiden. Okay? What's a young maiden going to do, according to this verse? She's going to give birth. So it can mean either a young girl or it can mean a virgin. You can be a young girl, not be a virgin, but if you're a virgin, you're usually a young girl. She's going to give birth. Well, if this is the work of God, it's not likely that this is an illegitimate birth, okay, kind of thing, and that it's use of an unmarried girl, okay? It's use of a maiden, not a married woman, just like the French have a term for mademoiselle and madam, married and unmarried. We have miss and misses. So this is a term for an unmarried maiden. And she cannot be a virgin, it's possible. But this is a work of God here, so that's why translators have always leaned toward the virgin interpretation of this. And when you see the way it's used in Matthew 1, it lines up, okay? Because that's where you see it. So the sign is, before a virgin gives birth, and this child, okay, as it says there, knows good and evil. Verse 16, in other words, before this child gets very big, what's going to happen at the end of verse 16? What's going to happen to the king of Israel and the king of Syria? Wiped out. So again, an assurance that Israel and Syria is not a threat to you. So this is where the prophecies get challenging. How is it that the birth of the Messiah 400 years later, no, it's 600 years later, it's more like almost 800 years later. Okay, there we go. My brain had to catch up where we're at. Almost 800 years later, how is the Messiah's birth going to be comfort to Judah at this point in King Ahaz? Well, it's a great question. And we'll keep working on that this year. But it's like this. God is saying, trust me. In the future, I'm in control and my plan's going to be carried out. That's what he's communicating. And look at verse 17. What does he depict in verse 17? Does it sound like something wonderful or something sort of scary? Scary. And he compares it. Not since what days? It's like somebody saying, we just had a flood in Asheville and we've not had a flood like that since 19... When was that big flood? 16, 17, Frank? When was it? You remember? Okay. There's a huge flood in Asheville around 1916, something like that. Okay, 17. Huge flood. You don't remember? Okay. It's like somebody saying, we've not had a flood like that since 1916, whatever that year was. It's right in there somewhere. What does he refer back to? It's going to be such days since what? Since when Israel broke, or Ephraim broke from Judah, the beginning of the divided kingdom, which is during the reigns of Jeroboam and Rehoboam after Solomon. And that was a shock. You got God's people who divided. And then they became, you know, they had an animosity toward each other. They almost had a war with each other. I mean, that was a devastating thing for Israel to be broken up like that. It's like a civil war, like in America kind of thing. And not since those days have you experienced something like this. You know what's going to happen? Assyria is going to happen. Assyria is not only going to take care of Syria, only Assyria is going to come in and wipe out Israel. Assyria is going to deliver a vicious blow to Judah, though it won't be toppled. More on that later. So, in other words, you think things are bad now, Ahaz? You think Israel and Syria are a threat? They don't compare to what's going to happen. And he's going to get into that here. So, you know what? Again, this benefits us. If you are a selfish, shallow person focused on the moment, none of this means anything to you. You're talking about things in the future. That's not helping me today. And that's a challenge that we have as God's people, is that he calls us to have faith and wait on him. Yeah, yes.
So what you say about God's vision of things versus ours, oftentimes the problems in front of us are so important to us that we can't see God's plan as being revealed. And God is speaking here of time frames that exceed the lifetimes of perhaps the people that he's speaking to.
Absolutely.
And that happened in the prophets, happened in, perhaps in Daniel's time, and things that would come to pass at a later time. But Hebrews makes it clear that all these died in faith without receiving the promises. There were things that were coming on. And he says, all these having gained approval through the faith did not receive what is promised. There is a thing that was happening that God was speaking of that far exceeded the time on earth. And our seeing it as God sees, the vision, the eyes that God has, we have to think beyond perhaps what is directly in front of us and the problems that are facing us at the very moment.
You have something on that line?
Yeah, well...
Okay, go, and then I'm going to add. Go ahead.
Line with that, I think the assurance is that God, and you indicated this already, but that God is in complete control of everything that is happening. And that's where the assurance really lies, it seems to me.
So we know for sure Isaiah is writing about one thing that's going to happen in 65 years, just a long time, to a human. He's describing the Messiah, which is going to be centuries later. And that's, you see that a lot in the prophetic writings, things that are happening way, 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 way down the line. Now let's think about this. To the Lord, 1,000 years is what? And a day is as 1,000 years. Now what that means is not just that the Lord is so eternal that 1,000 years passes like a day, as much as God doesn't measure time. Time is all about constraint. I've got an hour to do this. God never works that way. God never has only an hour to do anything. God never has even only a century to do anything. He may take 5 centuries before he does something. In other words, God operates outside of time. Our faith has to do the same. Our faith has to operate outside of time. It's not about what God's going to do and when he's going to do it. It's about trusting that he'll do what he says he's going to do. This is not for wimps, is it? I mean, this is what you call big boy pants faith, what the prophets are requiring of us. It really is. Mike?
I just would like to add that, I mean, even when you're talking about chapter 6, about, hey, Isaiah, you're going to go out and do all these things, or, you know, I'm going to make you do all these things, you're not going to listen, and, you know, the personal perspective might be, well, let's, you know, that doesn't sound good for me, you know, but God's plan yeah. is completely different.
Yeah.
There's no difference in what he's telling Ahaz here.
Right.
And the perspective, as Justin said, I think the same thing can be found in our perspective. We have to take the long view of our lives. We have to think about our children's grandchildren. And are they going to remain faithful by our influence today? I mean, how are we as a church, how are we as a society going to be workers in God's kingdom? We just studied this in Romans chapter 12, and I think I'd read these first 2 verses at this time. It says, I beseech you, brethren, therefore by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. That's your job. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. It's God's will that you be a Christian and that you think and take the long view and not be concerned about so many of the little petty things that we can be concerned about today. God has a plan. Do your job, which is to be a Christian.
We know from 2 Peter 1 and other things that the prophets did not have a complete mastery understanding of what they were writing about. They didn't understand all the particulars about the Messiah and his kingdom, okay? But think about this. Isaiah had some idea that in the future, near future, medium future, far, 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 far off future, God would be God. He would rule. He would be victorious. His people would be blessed. He would do great things. He knew that. So even he had that task of that's described at the latter part of Isaiah 6. He has to go and speak to a people who will not hear, to a people who will not see. Isaiah still knew, because of these prophecies that will come through him, that though he may not see certain results, that God's plan will always be accomplished and great things will come from that. Isaiah knew that, didn't he? And so, again, this is a lot of faith we're called to have in God's work. So, And this is what we do with the prophets. There are so many particulars that are challenging, and sometimes the specifics elude our grasp, but it's pulling these kinds of grand thoughts. That's how they help us. So, What happens next here is that he continues in chapter 7. Chapter 7. See, I haven't looked. I haven't done that part. If you look here, after he gives the sign of the virgin being born, that terrible things are going to happen, that Israel and Syria will be defeated. Those two kings will be defeated. However, what you need to really worry about, verse 17, is days where something bigger is going to happen. And look at the metaphor. At the end of verse 17, what does he say? What's going to be the big threat at the end of verse 17? He just says it here. King of Assyria. See that? That's what you really should be concerned about. And there's the irony of Joe mentioned. He thought that Ahaz thought that was the help. No, that's the real threat in the long run. Years ahead, many years ahead after Ahaz. So look at the metaphors he uses about the Assyrian invasion, which will happen to Israel and Judah, by the way. Verse 18, it's going to be like what? God's going to call for what? Flies and bees, okay? Now, here's the thing about it. That doesn't sound like that big of a deal. But how did little flying creatures affect the Egyptians? Okay? Because look at the description here. This bee is going to be settle in the ravines, the clefts of the rocks, the thorn bushes, and all the pastures. In other words, it's going to just blanket everything. Okay? Yeah, Joe?
During the conquest of the land, the Lord inferred that he was going to send hornets, before the Israelites.
Yeah, which, again, was metaphoric. Okay? And if you've ever been around a hornet, they're pretty scary, but they're small. Okay? This is metaphoric. He is going to invade the land with the Assyrians like a bunch of killer bees everywhere. Now, what's the other metaphor in verse 20? Assyria's invasion is going to be like what? Like a man shaving with a razor. So here you got a bunch of hair on your face, and you take a sharp razor, and there it goes. It's just clean, and it's like a baby's bottom like mine this morning. Okay? Clean. All gone. That's the kind of invasion Assyria will have. And we've already talked about how vicious the Assyrians could be. So, which brings us to chapter 18. It's all the time we have. So what happens really over the next couple chapters, 8, 9, and the beginning of 10, is that he elaborates on this invasion of Assyria, why they're coming in and how bad it's going to be. But let me just make this one point, and there is reference to it here in chapter 8. We've talked about how that, I'm going to bring this up here, this map. We've talked about how that Assyria is going to come and conquer Israel. And Israel will fall and be wiped out by Assyria around 722 BC. And we talk about later that Babylon, that Judah will invade Babylon and conquer Babylon. That's nearly 150 years later. What we sometimes miss, it's right there in the text, but the simplification of what happens in the divided kingdom overlooks it, is that Assyria is also going to threaten Judah. Judah is going to be wiped out by Assyria except Jerusalem. Assyria will mow through Judah like a man cutting his beard off with a razor, except Jerusalem. More on that later. Okay, thank you very much.